Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello from Washington. We are here to help you improve your American English. At the same time, you will learn about interesting and important things happening all around us. Today we report on final preparations for the American visit of China's leader, Xi Jinping. Mr. Xi arrives in the United States early next week. Later in the program, we turn to Cambodia, where the government has agreed to accept refugees as part of an agreement with Australia. Let's get started. U.S. and Chinese officials have been meeting to prepare for the first official state visit to the United States by China's president. Mario Ritter has more.
Chinese and U.S. officials completed 4 days of meetings on cybersecurity issues last week. A statement from the Obama administration said U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice had a frank and open exchange about cyber issues. The Chinese delegation also met with the Federal Bureau of Investigation Director, James Comey, and representatives of the Justice, State, and Treasury Departments, and the intelligence community. The Obama administration is considering targeted sanctions against Chinese individuals and companies for cyber attacks against U.S. commercial targets. Chinese hackers also have been accused of hacking the U.S. government's personnel office this year. Goals related to global climate change are a topic both nations have been discussing for years. China and the United States are the two largest emitters of greenhouse gases. Those gases are linked to warming global temperatures and blamed for damaging weather patterns. Mayors, governors, and other leaders from both countries are meeting at the U.S.-China Climate Leaders Summit in Los Angeles. At that meeting, officials discussed plans to reduce carbon emissions that warm the atmosphere. The summit builds from the Climate Change Working Group established in 2013, and a joint announcement on climate change made by Presidents Obama and Xi in Beijing last November. The United States has announced a goal of reducing carbon emissions by 26% to 28% by 2025. China has set a national goal of reaching peak carbon emissions by 2030. However, the Obama administration says the cities of Beijing and Guangzhou have promised to reach their peak emissions by 2020. Developments in the South China Sea also are expected to be among the points of discussion. Pictures taken for the Center for Strategic and International Studies show a new 3,000-meter landing area for aircraft on Mischief Reef. The reef is an artificial island built by China in the Spratly Islands group. Security experts say the airstrip is big enough to be used by military aircraft. It would be the third airstrip China has placed in the South China Sea. Vietnam, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Malaysia also have built airstrips on islands in the disputed waters. However, China's land reclamation projects in the sea are much larger. A spokesman for the U.S. Defense Department, Commander Bill Urban, did not comment on the new pictures. But he said the U.S. repeatedly has called for a halt to land reclamation, construction, and militarization of the South China Sea. It is estimated that more than $5 trillion in trade passes through the body of water each year. Rights groups also want President Obama to make human rights an important point of discussion. 9 human rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, signed a joint letter. They express deep concern about the significant erosion to rights during President Xi's tenure. I'm Mario Ritter.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm George Groh in Washington. A mixed group of refugees is set to arrive in Cambodia next month under an agreement with Australia. 3 refugees from Iran and a Rohingya from Myanmar will arrive in October as part of the agreement. Reports say Cambodia will receive as much as $40 million in aid from Australia in exchange for accepting the asylum seekers. Bob Doty has more.
The refugees have been living temporarily on the Pacific island of Nauru. They are the second group to go to Cambodia. Q Sofik is with Cambodia's Interior Ministry. On Monday, he spoke about the refugees and their expected arrival time. The ministry is sending officials to interview them, he said. Details of the agreement between Australia and Cambodia have mostly been kept secret. But many human rights groups are critical of the deal. So are religious groups and opponents of the ruling parties in both countries. Elaine Pearson is the Australia director of the rights group Human Rights Watch. The reality is Cambodia is both unsafe and unprepared to handle large numbers of refugees, she told the Reuters news service. This new group of refugees would only be the second group Cambodia would accept under the deal. The first group arrived in June. One member of that 4-person group has already asked to return to Myanmar, the country which he fled. The deal has received increased criticism now that Australia just agreed to accept 12,000 Syrian and Iraqi refugees. Critics say that Australia is not treating all refugees equally. The Cambodian Human Rights and Development Association is the country's oldest human rights group. Naya Chakria, a rights officer for the group, said, "There should be no discrimination like this. Australia has shown its discrimination." Some observers believe that more than 600 refugees and asylum seekers are living on Nauru. Manus Island in Papua New Guinea is holding hundreds more under a different agreement with Australia. Most of these people are from countries in South Asia and the Middle East. The United Nations Refugee Agency says the deal between Australia and Cambodia is in conflict with the main ideas of the Refugee Convention. This international agreement defines who is a refugee and how they should be treated. Both countries signed this treaty in the past. I'm Bob Doty.
Thanks, Bob. By the way,
Bob will be retiring at the end of the month. We are really thankful for all his help over the years. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. Brazil is seeking to reduce a budget deficit that led to a drop in the country's credit rating last week. On Monday, the government announced spending cuts and tax increases totaling almost $17 billion. The government said it plans to bring back the CPMF, a tax on financial transactions. The government hopes to raise more than $8 billion next year if Congress accepts the tax. However, many lawmakers oppose the measure. Other proposed cuts would reduce government aid for farmers, infrastructure improvements, and pay for government employees. Public health and low-cost housing programs could also face cuts. The government reduced tax subsidies for the chemical industry. It also reduced aid for exporters of manufactured goods and raised taxes on capital gains, profits from sales of investments. The most recent measures are meant to cut a deficit in the budget next year. Brazil's economy has shrunk for the past 6 months. That means its economy is in recession. At the same time, President Dilma Rousseff has experienced a drop in popularity. Opposition members in Congress dismiss the cost-cutting measures as too little. Some are calling for the president to resign. The Reuters News Service reports that economists have said the expected savings look promising. However, it remains unclear if the measures will clear Congress without amendments. The Speaker of Brazil's lower house of Congress, Eduardo Cunha, said the president's administration lacked the support needed in Congress to approve the proposed return of the CPMF tax. The head of the Brazilian Senate, Renan Calheiros, said deeper cuts were needed to reduce the size of the federal government before Congress will agree to more taxes. Government officials also say 10 ministries will be closed to save money. The proposed reduction in public health and housing spending will be difficult for supporters of President Rousseff. Her Workers' Party has resisted cuts to social programs. Predictions of a big budget deficit in 2016 caused Brazil to lose its high credit rating last week. The rating agency Standard & Poor's no longer considers the country's credit rating as investment grade. The downgrade means some foreign investment funds and other large investors may be forced to sell Brazilian government bonds. However, the value of Brazilian money, the real, increased on news of the cost-cutting measures to reduce the deficit. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter. Thank you.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. In 1823, President James Monroe introduced one of the most important foreign policy decisions in American history. It became known as the Monroe Doctrine. The doctrine said the United States never had and never would take part in any war between the European powers. At the same time, it warned the Europeans against interfering in the Western Hemisphere. Monroe declared that the Americas are not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers. Historian Harlow Giles Unger says the Monroe Doctrine marked the end of the colonial era.
The United States now considered the entire Western Hemisphere our sphere of influence, that we would keep out of their affairs, but they must keep out of our affairs.
The United States continued to grow. New states joined the Union. Indiana, Mississippi, Illinois, and Alabama all became states before 1820. Louisiana had earlier become the first state to be formed from part of the Louisiana Territory that the United States bought from France. The rest of this huge area was called the Missouri Territory. By 1819, there were enough people in part of the Missouri Territory for that part to become the state of Missouri. But becoming a state required the approval of Congress. And historian Harlow Giles Unger says admitting Missouri would have changed the balance of power in the Senate.
The Senate gave each state 2 votes. And by convention, since the signing of the Constitution, the Senate was evenly divided between slave states and non-slave states. So the admission of Missouri would have added a slave state to the Senate and left the northern non-slave states as a minority, and they were not going to accept this.
Slaves were not new in America. Spain had brought them to the West Indies hundreds of years before. In 1619, a ship brought 20 African slaves to Jamestown, Virginia. These black men were sold to farmers. Over the years, the use of slaves spread to all the American colonies. However, there were many more slaves in the agricultural South than in the North. The farms in the North were smaller and needed less labor. But in the South, farms were much larger. Slaves were the least expensive form of labor. Most of the northern states had passed laws before 1800 freeing slaves. Even the southern states made it illegal to import more slaves from Africa. But those southerners who already owned slaves believed they were necessary, and they refused to free them. Slavery had been legal when France and Spain controlled the Louisiana Territory. The United States did nothing to change this when it purchased the territory. So slavery was permitted in the Missouri Territory at the time Missouri asked for statehood. A New York congressman, James Talmadge, offered an amendment to Missouri's request to become a state. Talmadge proposed that no more slaves be brought into Missouri and that the children of slaves already there be freed at the age of 25. His proposal started a debate that lasted a year. Supporters of Talmadge argued that his proposed amendment was constitutional. The Constitution, they said, gave Congress the right to admit new states into the Union. This also meant, they said, that Congress could refuse to admit new states unless these states met conditions demanded by Congress. Supporters of the amendment also said small farmers of the North and East could not compete with the Southern farmers and the free labor of slaves. They argued that these Northern and Eastern farmers had as much right to the land of Missouri as anyone else. The Louisiana Territory had been paid for by the taxes of all Americans. Those opposed to slavery also argued that slaveholding states would be given too great a voice in the government if Missouri joined them. Under the Constitution, only 3 out of every 5 slaves were counted in the national population. The census, taken every 10 years, is used to set the number of members for each state in the House of Representatives. In the House, unlike the Senate, the number of votes that a state has is based on its population. In the past, each time a slave state was admitted to the Union, a free state had also been admitted. Herlow Giles Unger explains what the supporters of the amendment may have been thinking.
The problem, basically, was not so much a moral problem from their point of view. It was much moral as it was economic, because the northern states could not compete with southern states. Northern states paid their labor by the piece. In the South, slave labor was free of charge. So the South had a tremendous economic advantage. They could produce goods at much lower cost than the North. And the advent of a majority in the Senate would have tilted the balance of power.
Southerners had an answer for each argument of those supporting the Talmadge Amendment. They agreed that Congress had the constitutional right to admit or reject a state. But they said Congress did not have the right to make conditions for a territory to become a state. William Pinckney of Maryland argued that states already in the Union had joined without any conditions. If Congress, he declared, had the right to set conditions for new states, then these new states would not be equal to the old ones. The United States would no longer be a union of equal states. The debate was intense on both sides. The House of Representatives passed the Missouri bill with the Talmadge Amendment, but the Senate rejected it. The people of Missouri would try again for statehood when the new Congress met in 1820. By this time, another free state was ready to enter the Union. Maine, with the permission of Massachusetts, asked to become a separate state. The Senate joined the Maine bill with the one for unconditional statehood for Missouri. Senators refused to separate the two, and so they continued to debate about conditions for statehood and slavery. Finally, Senator Jesse Thomas of Illinois offered a compromise. He said Maine could be admitted as a free state and Missouri as a state permitting slavery. But he said that no other state allowing slavery could be formed from the northern part of the Louisiana Territory. Many Southerners were not satisfied. The compromise closed the door against slavery entering large new areas of land. Southerners, like any other Americans, had a right to settle in the new territory. The Senate accepted Thomas's compromise. Congress approved statehood for both Missouri and Maine. Now President Monroe just needed to sign the bills. It was the spring of 1820. James Monroe was coming to the end of his first 4 years as president. He wanted to be elected again, but he faced a difficult decision about whether to allow the Missouri Compromise. President Monroe owned slaves. He understood the feelings of the South. His friends urged him to veto the compromise bill because it limited slavery in the territory. He also understood the strong feelings of those who opposed slavery. Monroe believed the compromise was wrong, but not because it kept slaves out of the territory. The president did not believe the Constitution gave Congress the right to make such conditions. Monroe even wrote a veto message explaining why he could not approve the compromise, but in the end, he did not use his veto. He believed there might be civil war if he rejected the compromise. So Monroe signed the bill. Missouri had permission to enter the Union as a slave state. The crisis seemed to end, but a few months later, a new problem developed. Missouri wrote a state constitution that it sent to Congress for approval. One part of this constitution did not permit free black men to enter the state. A number of lawmakers in Congress immediately opposed the state constitution. They said it violated the United States Constitution. The United States Constitution said citizens of each state had the same rights as citizens of each of the other states. And since free black men were citizens of some states, they should have the right to be citizens of Missouri. The debate lasted several months. Former House Speaker Henry Clay finally proposed a compromise that both sides accepted. Missouri could become a state if its legislature would make this promise. It would never pass any law that would violate the rights of any citizen of another state. This second compromise ended the dispute over slavery in Missouri and the Louisiana Territory. The Compromise Actions of 1820 settled the crisis of slavery for more than 20 years. But everyone knew that the settlement was only temporary. Former President Thomas Jefferson expressed his feelings with these words: "This momentous question, like a fire bell in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. I considered it at once as the knell of the Union. It is hushed, indeed, for the moment. But this is a reprieve only," he said, "not a final sentence." The effect of Monroe's decision and the election of 1820 will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, our program of American history from VOA Learning English.